It's Monday, July 5th, and it's usually not a good sign for rescue teams when you're bringing in explosives. We start here. Half a condo building collapsed. Well, now the other half is gone too.
The best way to continue to search a collapsed building is to blow up the part of it that is still standing.
Gut-wrenching decisions have been made in Florida overnight. Our team is on site. President Biden declares independence from COVID.
America is coming back together.
But officials are still concerned that we're not getting enough Americans vaccinated. And what's it like to be a college athlete this morning? Well, ask their agents.
If they do endorsements, they can leverage their social media, they can do coaching sessions and get paid.
The seismic shift that just changed how college athletics work in America. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Hey, hope you had a good 4th of July wherever you are. Maybe you got the day off today, maybe you didn't. Either way, we're here, so let's get up to speed together on what's happening.
I said, oh my God, where's the building? There's no building.
Just don't take anything. We just grabbed something that was in the way, my wallet and the phones, and we just ran.
As of this morning, the national mystery continues to be, how did a 12-story building with hundreds of residents just suddenly crumble to the ground in Surfside, Florida, and how many of those residents were caught inside? Sadly, it almost seems like we know more about the answer to that second question than the first, because in the last several days, more and more remains of residents have been found.
Just to have someone or a piece of someone that they could bury and have closure and just have somewhere to pray to is so important for us.
And since we don't know a ton about what allowed this building to collapse, that has added a layer of anxiety to an already tragic scene. In fact, they canceled fireworks shows in Miami last night, but after the sun went down, a different set of explosions did go off and actually brought what remained of that structure crashing to the ground. ABC's Trevor Ault is there in Surfside, Florida. Trevor, what happened here?
Well, Brad, what we've seen is essentially Florida officials making what could be considered an unfathomable decision in the past, that they say the best way to continue to search a collapsed building is to blow up the part of it that is still standing.
We have experts right now on site evaluating, and the contract has been signed for the demolition to begin.
And that was something that they really have wavered on back and forth over the past several days. They said that it was going to take weeks at one point, and then they hurried it up because of the threat of Tropical Storm Elsa moving in.
This will protect our search and rescue teams because we don't know when it could fall over. And of course, with these gusts potentially, you know, that would create a really severe hazard.
And they have to do it in a very careful fashion because, as you can imagine, on top of wanting to preserve and protect the people who could very well be buried in the rubble, they also have an investigation into what caused this collapse, and they need to be able to determine which part of it collapsed and which part of it is demolished.
But carefully demolish it. Like, we saw the explosions go off. Like, they imploded this building. How did this work?
Our understanding from demolitions experts is that they have to drill into columns, which in itself puts that building with its structural instability at further risk. So they had to pause the search and rescue.
You put the dynamite into the columns, and then you wrap the columns with geotech material, chain link fence, and more geotech material. That takes time.
They've gotten really good at demolition. Certainly, you've seen videos of maybe former sports arenas where they can bring it, for the most part, straight down.
The first columns to go will be the street columns. The next columns to go will be the next columns, and then the next columns, and then the next columns. So you're stiff-legging the building. So the gravity will pull it almost straight, everything straight down, but it will have a little tilt to it.
And the design is that the building comes down to the west, away from the rubble of the already collapsed building. But that is a very, very tricky assignment. And actually, Brad, when we talked to a demolitions expert on Saturday and told them they're going to do this tomorrow, he didn't believe it at first. He said there's no way because these things take weeks or months of planning.
And it is expected, as I said, as soon as the all clear in the middle of the night, our search and rescue operation will resume and we'll go to that pile.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, so this is, I mean, this was a huge building. They've been saying they're still in a search and rescue mission. They've been careful not just to go, like,
demolishing the rubble that's already on the ground, right? Which brings all of this, it sounds like, would just bring a ton more rubble down out of the sky. So I guess the uncomfortable question here, are they saying that the rescue part of search and rescue is done here?
The way that they talk about it, yes, they insist this is still a search and rescue mission, and they are stressing that by bringing down the rest of this structure, it is actually going to help them with the searching and rescuing because they no longer have the threat of a building looming over them. And they will be able to access more areas.
When the site has been deemed secure and we are given the all clear, which should happen very shortly after the demolition, our search and rescue teams will immediately resume their operations.
Having said that, now we're now closing in on 2 weeks of this search and rescue operation of a building coming straight down. And since the operation began, Brad, to be blunt, they have not found survivors alive in this rubble.
How would you describe what you have seen?
I've been around the world in disasters for the last 20-something years, and for me, it took me straight back to September 11th.
I talked with one rescue worker who told me that she felt like the crews were at the gates of hell.
But the only difference this time is, you know, we can't find the door in. So.
Even more grim, a member of the Israeli Defense Force, they have been on the ground helping out from the beginning. They have since left this weekend. That member of the IDF said, when asked, after the demolition, can we find someone who is still alive? And he said the chance of that happening was zero.
The circumstances, as we saw the last few days, are too difficult for me to say professionally that I believe that there is a solid chance to find somebody alive.
Wow. Wow. And still over 100 people unaccounted for. Then, Trevor, I'm still just confused on the cause of this, right? Like, what are the realistic scenarios that could have resulted in this kind of catastrophe? Because it seems like other residents in the area, like some of these buildings were made in similar time frames. They're all on similar beachfront soil. Like, I would want to know.
Of course. And what we know, at least so far, from the structural engineers who are looking into this is that this investigation will take months. We've also heard from engineers who say that this building probably had some kind of catastrophic flaw or damage that went unnoticed, and maybe construction of a nearby building is what triggered it. But beyond that, we don't have a lot of answers.
Something inside of me said, run, because this building will collapse.
What we do know is that there are multiple lawsuits that have been filed against the condo association board. There are multiple tenants saying there were tens of thousands, if not millions of dollars of repairs that needed to be done on this building.
There were clear, not just warning signs, but alarm bells ringing for years about the state of this condo.
And now also, Brad, because of some of these other neighboring cities that are launching their own investigations into the certifications of their high-rise condos, we've seen at least one building that was evacuated late Friday night because they learned an engineer had decided it was structurally and electrically unsafe.
You have to evacuate tonight.
We have to evacuate ASAP. Being in that building right now is not safe.
This report, dated January, shows poor surface conditions in this 1972-built building.
We learned that the engineer made that ruling back in January. And city officials said they didn't even know about it until they launched this investigation. And they said to all these condo high-rises, if you don't have your certification up to date, you need to file your paperwork. The owners of the building filed the paperwork with that engineer's report that said 6 months ago, an engineer said our building is unsafe. So do I think that the people of Miami and Miami Beach and South Beach, do I think they need to be panicking that their building could collapse at any moment? No, but I think a lot of people around here are double-checking and triple-checking their status of their building and investing in repairs that maybe they've been putting off in the past.
Right, and if we're talking about fears over construction creating damage in other buildings, imagine what fears of a demolition nearby would mean to you.
Absolutely.
Right now. The building, by the way, which is facing a lot of lawsuits, says an independent receiver should be appointed to oversee the legal and claims process from here on out. Trevor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brett.
Next up on Start Here, lots of people had backyard cookouts this weekend, but most of them didn't have 1,000 people. The White House turns a corner after the break.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question.
You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today we celebrate America.
The other big story this weekend, of course, was it was the 4th of July. And every Independence Day is an opportunity for Americans to reflect on where we are as a country. But this year's holiday was billed by the White House itself as a national turning point.
Today, all across this nation, we can say with confidence, America is coming back together.
Well, yesterday, 478 days after the White House declared a national emergency over the novel coronavirus, President Biden hosted a cookout of his own.
But the best defense against these variants is to get vaccinated.
But remember, President Biden had originally said that the goal for this whole celebration was Americans getting vaccinated in huge numbers. If 70% of American adults got their shots, he said, we could party. Well, that hasn't happened yet. ABC's White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks is at the White House right now. Mary Alice, I mean, did this feel like a mission accomplished moment? Like, how big of a backyard cookout are we talking about?
This was a big party. The president had said that he had hoped Americans would enjoy 4th of July barbecues, and so he threw one himself with 1,000 people.
We can thank the scientists and researchers, the educators, and all the other frontline and essential workers, like many of you here today.
Military families, first responders, this was the biggest event of his presidency here at the White House. Clearly, they were trying to say that this was a date, a turning point, like you said, that would mark a new chapter in the fight against the coronavirus. But the president also missed his self-imposed deadline. Instead of reaching that 70% benchmark, only about 67% of American adults will have received one coronavirus shot by the end of this weekend.
Which is close-ish, right? So, I mean, going forward, I'm just trying to get a sense of how confident is the Biden administration that Americans are safe from COVID and that they're safe from, you know, this Delta variant or a new variant.
The White House this last week said that they would start sending surge teams to communities across the country that have high transmission rates. Because look, we're seeing that.
The vast majority of people who have died from COVID-19 were not vaccinated. So help us to urge folks and say to them, look, it's time to roll up your sleeves and get the shot.
Over the weekend, before the big barbecue, we saw the president, the vice president, the first lady all out around the country continuing to tell people to get their vaccine.
70% of adults here have had at least one dose. Thank you for that, Philadelphia.
And especially to get their second dose, we know that millions of Americans have actually put off getting that second dose if it's needed. And so that's a big part of the White House's push, too.
When we first visited West Virginia last January, at the beginning of the vaccine rollout, it was a success story. But today, at this local health department...
Now we're back down to doing 8 to 10 a day.
8 to 10 a day?
Yes.
How do you convince those people who aren't getting it to do it?
Well, any way we can.
The White House says there's still an issue with access. We know in our latest poll that among those who are not vaccinated, 74% are saying that they probably or definitely won't get the shot. So it is not just a question of access and opportunity. That is clearly a question of hesitancy around the vaccine, and especially with young people.
You're not vaccinated?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I just don't believe in it, I guess.
Their reasoning? They're young and healthy.
Why not?
Right now I don't think I'm at risk for it that much.
It's hard to talk about all young people all across the country, but we've felt that a little bit. Young people who I think either feel like they're not going to get as sick or they haven't seen it in their lives. And so there's going to continue to be, a tension on making sure especially young people are getting the shot now that it's available to them.
Yeah, and you talk about 74% of people who are not vaccinated, not being particularly interested. That does leave 26% of Americans who are either on the fence or still looking for that opportunity to get a shot. So clearly the Biden administration reaching out to them. Mary Alice Parks at the White House. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
It's been a big weekend for sports. One, Sha'Carri Richardson, perhaps the fastest woman on earth, has now been banned from running in the 100-meter dash at the Olympics because she tested positive for marijuana.
The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency confirmed that Richardson had tested positive for marijuana use.
Richardson apologizing, taking responsibility for her actions, and admitting she smoked marijuana to cope with the death of her biological mother.
Meanwhile, yesterday, there was no drug test for the biggest competition of munchies in the world, as Joey Chestnut set a new record for hot dogs consumed in 10 minutes.
With 76 Nathan's Hot Dogs and Bun!
But for all the fanfare, there are a ton of athletes in this country with way more name recognition than either of the folks I just named, yet if they were college athletes, they couldn't actually profit off of their popularity.
I always felt like the rules of the NCAA represented indentured servitude.
Until last week. Last week, amid mounting legal pressure, the NCAA decided that college athletes will no longer be prohibited from capitalizing off their name and likeness. These rules were rescinded Wednesday night. Well, by Thursday morning, some of them were already making deals. You want to talk about big contracts? You go to ABC's business correspondent Deirdre Bolton. So, Deirdre, thanks for being with us. Are college athletes allowed to get, paid starting now? How does this work?
They sure are, Brad. So for the first time ever, college athletes can get paid for their name and their image and their likeness. So that sounds like a technical term, but it really means if they do endorsements, they can leverage their social media, they can do coaching sessions and get paid, they can make personal appearances, they can sign autographs.
The Badgers starter wasted no time, becoming the first active college athlete to file for a trademark for his GM logo.
Everybody always has that vision of putting your logo on a shirt, on a hat, whatever you can, and then making money off it.
There is one caveat, though. The rule change is only allowed in states where the practice is not against the law. This is the biggest change to college sports since Title IX, that gender equity law that was put in place almost 50 years ago.
Wow. Okay. And so the first people I think of when I hear student athletes can get paid, I think of the megastars, right? I think of the huge, huge football, basketball players. You've been reporting that a lot of the athletes we've never heard of could be making life-changing money starting now, though. How does that work?
Brad, some will make life-changing money, but for some, it's really just diversification. It's just a different form, a different way to express themselves.
We didn't get the deal until 12 a.m. on July 1st.
So, Brad, this is happening as we speak. The second that ban was lifted, some of these student athletes have been able to capitalize almost immediately.
Boost Mobile wanted to have a contract with us and was super interested. So we were like, oh my gosh, this is crazy.
Hannah and Haley Cavender, they are Fresno State basketball stars. They are twin sisters. They have millions of followers between TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter. And now they can leverage their social media savvy. They've already signed a deal with Boost Mobile. I think there's even a billboard of them in Times Square, which went up really quickly.
Just took some pictures and TikToks in Times Square. They just posted their first ad for Boost Mobile. How are we feeling?
Insane. 3 a.m., but we're rallying.
Yes, we got more content to create.
So this is changing the lives of many different types of athletes, maybe from sports which are less commercial. I'm thinking of swimming and diving or volleyball or soccer.
Welcome to Woodward Camp.
I'm
Hallie Raisman, the gymnastics program designer.
Also, one agent that I spoke with says that 2/3 of his student athlete clients are women. So he really sees it as an opportunity for women to leverage their social media presence or any other kind of personal activity. I can think of a few examples, setting up a camp in their hometown, doing coaching, endorsing a business.
Oh, right. Like I'm thinking of gymnasts, softball players, like divers. There are camps for this that kids will, like families will seek out people who have experience, especially ones that their kids are clamoring over. This would be your chance to make money throughout the summer.
Exactly. There's also a really other fun example. There's a student athlete called Will Ulmer. He's an offensive lineman at Marshall.
Can't get that downtown these days. It's a down home kind of thing.
He's also a musician, Brad, and he loves music and football pretty much the same. And he said he always felt like he was forced to choose.
There are all kind of different activities and hobbies and passions that were being prohibited. And I just think it's huge.
Because he says that music just helps him relax and he would play these local venues in his college town, but he couldn't accept money for playing in these local venues because had he accepted money for music, his scholarship eligibility for football would have been vulnerable. So he was actually playing under an alias, Lucky Bill. And so now he said, just from a personal standpoint, he says it's just nice for him that he doesn't really have to hide the fact that he's also a football player.
Also to have other sources of income is also important to help just like save and put away money and get ready for the real world.
There are numerous examples of people who do have an amazing social media presence or who come from a very small town. And in that town, they are truly hometown heroes. And every single business from where they came from wants in some way to be associated with that person.
Right. And it makes me wonder if the dynamics of college sports change over this, recruiting changes, because now a kid who is leaving college to go pro, well, you could conceivably stay in college an extra year if you're making money from, you know, a video game that has your face on it. On the other hand, you wonder if these schools that have really profited off of nobody making money in the commercial realm, like Gonzaga in Eastern Washington, people go to play there. Well, now you wonder if somebody's telling them, hey, you could make more money doing commercials at UCLA or USC, like you're right in the media capital. Does that change things for some smaller schools going forward? Deirdre Bolton, fascinating stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to step away once more, but when we come back, Free Wally, One Last Thing, is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Here in the U.S., it was a great day to celebrate newly naturalized citizens. But elsewhere, it's a deportation that's making waves.
We've been bringing you the adventures of Wally the Walrus. He's making his way around the British coastline.
In an English harbor, a walrus named Wally has become something of a local mascot in recent weeks. He came to town one day after floating south from the Arctic Circle on a sheet of ice. After swimming from town to town, he settled into an island called St. Mary's. And at first, people just marveled at his size.
Oh, he's up. He's heavy.
He's actually on the boat now.
Then they marveled at how unafraid he was, how friendly. He'd come right up to your boat.
He's on our diving platform again.
But those factors, they now say, have made him a menace.
Get off, boy.
Wally is now responsible for damaging and even sinking boats around this harbor as he tries to say hi and climb aboard vessels that cannot handle a 2,000-pound walrus.
Hey, watch my varnish.
Boaters have been complaining. The local harbor authority says it's been in touch with marine biologists and the local police to come up with a way to eject Wally from the marina. Part of this will be getting local boats to actively discourage him from swimming up to them. The other part, they say, will involve underwater acoustic devices to annoy him enough to leave. For a while, they tried above water techniques like air horns. Well, locals say he's gotten used to those. Some have asked why you don't just pack him up and return him to his homeland further north. A local marine rescue group says it would not be safe for anyone included, including Wally. But they also say this is an animal that was displaced from his home, perhaps by climate change. He managed to make his way to Britain from Spain, where he was before. If he's tough enough to do all that, who's to say he's not persistent enough to just come right back? Dude, and Wally is a tank of a walrus, too. Like, he's very cute until he's climbing up on your boat, I imagine. All right, that'll do it for us. Hey, again, before it slides down in your feed, make sure you listen to this weekend's edition of Accountable with Rachel Scott and our buddy Mary Alice Parks was on this week, the final episode for now. If you want more of them, hey, let us know with a positive rating and review. I'm Brad Milkey. I'll see you tomorrow.